Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is May 2nd, 2024, and we're speaking with Skiramantis Giannoussonis, who is Associate Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Skiramantis' lab studies the brain serotonin neurons that innervate practically every place in the brain and in the spinal cord, and his work includes their interaction with other neurons and glia, involvement in a number of psychiatric disorders, comparative studies across a number of different species. And he has a unique and fascinating set of observations on the morphology of serotonin axons in the regions where they release transmitter and the quantitative approach to the geometrical description of their trajectories, which is mathematically related to descriptions of diffusion. And so we will be talking about that, I think, today. So, hi, Skiramantis.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Welcome. Also with us is Fidel Santamaria, who also has an interest in diffusion.
Hi.
And its variance, and is a longtime podcast participant. Hey, Fidel.
Hi, Charlie. How are you?
And I'm your host, Charlie Wilson. So, Skiramantis, why not get us started with just a little brief description of the serotonin innervation of the brain and spinal cord, and especially on the axonal trajectories of the serotonin axons and what's different about them compared to other axons in the brain.
Hello again. It's a very interesting system that I've been spending almost all my professional life on, and study different aspects of it. The system is ancient and massive, and that's what makes it very attractive, I think, from many points of view, be it biology or neuroscience or even computational neuroscience. So essentially what we have is a small number of neurons, relatively speaking, sitting in the brainstem, which send projections or axons to just about all parts of the brain. And the result of it is that just about any network in the brain ends up being embedded in these axons as if they were some kind of cotton ball fibers. There are so many of them that when you magnify and when you look at them, you see that they come in very close contact with just about any individual neuron in the brain. So the whole massiveness, the sheer massiveness of that system is truly astounding. It's also universally present in all vertebrates. So you can go back from mammals to reptiles, you can go to amphibians and fish, sharks, which we study also, and maybe we'll touch on this. And you see that this matrix of fibers will be present, again, in all of these species and on a very massive scale. It's also interesting because it's very ancient. So these neurons have been traced millions, hundreds of millions of years back, and they are seem to be at the very core of how any vertebrate neural tissue operates. So they are very appealing and intriguing from that point of view as well. Structurally, they can be imagined as just cell bodies sitting in the brainstem, the upper and lower brainstem, and then sending those axons to these different axons are very thin. I make this analogy often that a single axon is the width of a typical bacterium cell, so they are very, 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 very tiny, very fine, and look very complicated initially.
So what is the width of a typical bacterium?
So I'm not a microbiologist, so I have to be careful to see what's truly typical. But E. coli would be a couple of microns. So it would be 1-2 microns, something like that.
I think that's what the axon diameter
is. Right, and that's what the axon diameter.
That would be the length that be. Like all unicellular organisms, the length is about 1.2 microns in length. And the width of is about 0.2 to 0.5 of all unicellular, so yep.
And they can get very, actually, some fibers, some segments are so thin that they are barely visible or almost invisible with typical optical instruments. So it falls below that. But, you know, one micrometer is a good kind of average, I think, for a serotonin fiber. They are truly small.
So what makes them stand out? If I looked at some part of the brain, the cortex, say, and I decided I'm going to look at all the GABAergic axons, I'm going to look at the serotonin axons, I'm going to look at norepinephrine axons, how would I be able to, if I saw the serotonin axons, would I say, oh, that's serotonin, not GABA or norepinephrine?
Yeah, well, it would be difficult to immediately know that, so that you still need to label them to be absolutely sure this is a serotonin fiber. And the problem would be not so much maybe glutamatergic or other axons, but other axons such as norepinephrine or dopamine-producing axons, which share some similar properties to serotonin axons. That's not the same, but they are also a part, what's known as the ascending reticular activating system in the traditional literature, meaning that they originate in the brainstem, but then they project very widely across the brain. So serotonin is in that group of fibers. But that said, serotonin fibers do have unique properties. They accumulate at specific densities in specific brain regions, which would not overlap with, say, norepinephrine or dopamine. And they also can regenerate. They are one of the unique fibers in the mammalian brain, adult mammalian brain, that show very strong regenerative abilities. That's unusual, because normally you damage axons in the adult brain, they will not easily regenerate, especially to the whole extent that they used to be. These fibers will regenerate, but they will not trace the same pathways. So they can, an individual fiber may take a different path as it regenerates, which brings us, will eventually bring us to this discussion of the diffusion aspect of it.
But what are the correlates, at least, of the different densities of axons to the other, where they are innervating? Is it related to the cell numbers, or is it known?
It's not known. The mapping that's typically done is done in a very neurobiologically minded way, neuroanatomically and biologically, but also minded way. And that's partly because people think about neural systems in terms of specific nuclei or layers that are connected. Especially now with connectomics, it became even more prevalent. So you see, any circuit has to be cast in terms of neurobiological terms. So you'll say a specific cortical area projects to this, this projects to that. You end up with these graphs, which are, you know, can be analyzed by neurobiologists, but also analyzed by mathematicians as graphs. And that is the way of thinking here. However, I mean, with a serotonin system, this is not necessarily the case. And so what becomes important in the system is not just the specific nucleus that they project to, but something more generic that's present in the brain that may not be a specific nucleus or something like that. But things like geometry, the presence of obstacles, just physical obstacles, and when these fibers travel, that is important. But the question is a good one in the sense, do we see any patterns? If you still suppose you focus on a specific set of structures, can you just predictably say specific thalamic nuclei will have, you know, this density, and different nuclei will have a different density, layers will have different densities? That is actually one way to approach it, because you will see, for example, that layer one in almost all cortical areas have dense serotonin fiber, you know, high serotonin fiber mm-hmm. densities. Same thing with thalamic nuclei, such as, for example, lateral geniculate nucleus, which sits in the mouse brain, sort of in the corner of the thalamus, will have a higher density, and some other nuclei that are close to the edge will also have higher densities. So, but that is sort of the first order approach. What we are suggesting in our research is that when you look at the position of all of these, say layer one, by definition is a borderline layer. It's the layer that's closest to the pia that overlies the brain, and pia being one of the meninges. And all of these layers one will have high density. So we can say from the neuroanatomical perspective, layer one needs a high density. But we can also say all layers one sit close to the edge. And this is just an edge phenomenon. And
again, like a reflection.
We'll be getting into this, I think, in this discussion about the actual geometry. But and thalamic nuclei are the same. You can say, well, if you are in the visual system or auditory system, you simply need a lot of serotonin, like high densities of serotonin fibers. But also these nuclei happen to sit again at the edge, essentially, of the thalamus. And then we go deeper into like VPL, VPM, ventrolateral, medial, ventrolateral nucleus, ventral-posterior lateral, ventral-posterior medial nuclei, which are somatosensory nuclei. You have lower densities, but they also happen to sit deeper in the tissue. And so the question is it the function itself, or is it the location, just geometric, almost location, topological location of these particular nuclei? And so we've been trying to address some of
that. But if I understand, well, your work is like, if you imagine that the serotonergic axonal matrix is basically just filling up a sponge, right? And they're having, and the architecture of the sponge, then that's what how you end up with the concentration, right? Mm-hmm. And what it emerges from your analysis is that and it's consistent with all these ideas of maximum sampling of a volume, giving some constraints, is that you will get some kind of power law distributions in the lengths of these axons, which is then described dynamically with a super anomalous diffusion process. Mm-hmm. But I just want to contrast that. I mean, again, going back to my original question. So the liver of blood to the brain also has this kind of like, it's actually very kind of preserved pattern of, I'm going to say fractal, pattern of innervation that, I mean, it's the same in an elephant and a mouse apparently, but you don't get the same kind of, as far as I know, mm-hmm. you don't get the accumulation of blood vessels like on the edges of the brain, or do you?
Not to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. With blood vessels, however, there is more. The development of blood vessels is oxygen dependent. So there are factors that track oxygen levels, and mm-hmm. so they always dynamically sort of adjust. If there is less or more oxygen, mm-hmm. you get more or less development of, and this is fractal also, which does not necessarily imply, you know, fractional Brownian motion. Fractal structure, but it's not necessarily a stochastic motion. So I think for the audience, maybe we should just set that up a little bit, because just discuss maybe the model itself.
I'd like to ask how, if this distribution of axons tells us something about how it develops, about how as a neuroscientist, I look at it and I see, well, I should get one of two lessons, or maybe two lessons out of this. One is, these are like that because they followed some growth rules, mm-hmm. and that left them like that. And so maybe there's a growth rule that favors edges or something like that. And the other way of thinking about it that's natural to me is to think, well, this is like that because that's what serotonin needs to be. That's where it needs to be in order to do its job that it's supposed to do. And so that should tell me something about the job it's supposed to do. So maybe we should start with, what does it tell us about development of that?
So I'd prefer maybe so we'll get to that, but just to back up a little bit, and I just want to kind of explain what the model is, so that people listening can make sense of it. So essentially, we are assuming that the serotonin axons are not guided, or at least not fully guided, but instead spread out in the brain following a diffusion-like rule. But it's not simple diffusion, because simple diffusion is simple, and it's not like sugar being dissolved in a glass of water.
Can I stop you for a second? Right. Because we normally think that axons grow, that it's not like particles that are diffusing.
Right. And I can actually counter this with a few things. So for example, so axons do grow, but and they need growth factors. But the question is, can you separate in axons growth as extension from growth to a specific target? So can they just extend without knowing precisely where they're headed, and then have the guiding factor as a separate one? And in neurobiology, these things often get conflated, sort of put together as if this is one phenomenon. But, for example, recent studies have shown with magnetic beads, if you take an axon and forcefully pull it, sort of just pull it and try to make it longer, the axon seems to naturally respond to it. Instead of being damaged, provided the force is within a certain range, it activates transcriptional programs to fill it in with whatever else is needed to maintain that extended length. And so it seems like these are pliable entities that can grow without necessarily getting any kind of signaling. They just grow. And you can also see it obviously in cell cultures where we have highly impoverished media. Typically, there's enough medium to support the growth of these fibers, so they have all the growth factors, but they're not trying even to get anywhere. They'll just grow. You have it with cortical axons, you have with other axons. So I think the growth part itself is one thing, and being guided to specific targets, all the mechanisms, the slits, for example, and so on, the signaling molecules is a separate piece.
So good. What is diffusive about growth? Because I'm used to, if you say diffusion, my mind goes to here's a particle, here's a particle, here's a particle, and these particles are moving, and they don't leave any path behind them unless you see their path and draw their path. Maybe you're thinking of the axon's growth cone as a kind of particle, and that the axon leaves you a trail of where the growth cone diffused, or something like that. Is that what you mean?
That is precisely right. Right. So it's not, so the axon, once it's been, set and it has these other segments that are left behind the growth cone, of course, that does not diffuse anymore. So the idea is that stays put. What is diffusing is exactly that, that sort of amoeba-like growth cone. Because, again, any one of us who've seen actual growth cones, they're kind of scary. They're like active flames. They are very dynamic. They look at times like amoeba. Sometimes they look like just flame shooting out of them. They're very active. They're moving. But they also have kind of forward, backward motion a little bit. And if you kind of separated them, at least mentally, from the actual axon that they've produced, they start looking much more chaotic. And you can see it. It's sort of like an amoeboid kind of like an amoeba, almost kind of just moving semi-randomly.
But this could be the consequence of having a pattern of neural growth factors that are positive and negative. Mm-hmm. It's just that they are interfering. That what is anomalous is the interference pattern, and that has to do actually with actual anomalous diffusion processes that will generate a pattern that looks like with big concentrations here, negative concentrations here, and then the end result will be that the only way that the axon can go is through these complex chemical landscape. And the question will be, that could be true if the neurons that are producing the signals are there before the serotonergic axons grow, and that could be disputed if the serotonergic neurons create the mesh with little other kind of neuronal activity, and I don't know how much.
So it depends, you know, how homogeneous the distribution of these growth factors is. And for that, now in culture, I believe you would not have these kind of heterogeneous patches to stimulate this. In the actual neural tissue, probably you could have it, especially with the, you know, extracellular, mm-hmm. the complexity of the extracellular space, mm-hmm. because that is in itself a highly heterogeneous kind of geometric.
So if you let them grow into the culture in a dish, what do you see of these axons?
They move in any way they want. They can actually turn all the way around. So you see them sometimes making a complete 180-degree turn, mm-hmm. and just head back. And that is sort of my point, is that axons by themselves will extend happily as long as they have mm-hmm. the
But the statistics of the distribution of pathways that these axons generate into the, do you think are the same that what you see in
the what we're saying, mm-hmm. and again for the audience listening, we are trying to constrain, or it's not actually constraining, it's the opposite, almost expanding, but we are taking Brownian motion and saying Brownian motion is not a good model for mm-hmm. these guys, because obviously they don't move like molecules completely chaotically like Brownian motion. Fractional Brownian motion, especially super diffusion, gives it a little bit more order, because it implies correlations between increments. So that sort of stabilizes it from a neurobiological point of view, even though mathematically it's just simply an extension of Brownian motion. And so they do seem to be in culture, they do seem to be similar. We haven't studied this sort of like rigorously with, you know, doing mathematical analysis of this, but they do seem to behave in a kind of general, you know, super diffusion way. I think a bigger question is to me, what is the natural state of axons? If there is no guidance, what does a generic axon would do, right? So would it just grow? And if there's no guidance, can we, for example, take some axons that are very prescribed in how they normally project, say corticospinal, and if we knocked out all the guiding, would they become like serotonin fibers suddenly, just wandering right. aimlessly around the brain, not being serotonin fibers, but suddenly behaving like this? And this is something that's interesting to me, because serotonin fibers are considered to be one of the most ancient kind of structural elements of the brain. So they might, the stochasticity of that, or the kind of the diffusion aspect of this, may reflect the original ancient state of what neurons would do. So there'd be no kind of solidified, pre-described networks. Instead, you just connect in a semi-random, chaotic way, and then you'd probably tighten it up with activity.
But then, so in this super diffusive model, you see them like having Levy flights, like meaning that there are a particle can diffuse, but it jumps. It basically long jumps, right? Mm-hmm. So you scan an area, a volume, almost close to being Brownian, but then all of a sudden you have a long jump in space, right? And then again scan, and then long jump, and then scan. Is that what emerges?
That is an excellent question, and we did think about it, and it could be an explanation. So this Levy flights also lead to superdiffusion, mm-hmm, right? So mm-hmm. right, this is just a different kind of superdiffusion, but this model is not compatible mathematically with fractional Brownian motion. They're just built different in terms of their mathematical kind of apparatus. Let's say so. For a mathematician, these are very different processes. These are different processes. Mm. Yet they are both super diffusive. So the question is, which one? So fractional Brownian motion is appealing for a variety of reasons. Also because it pushes the math and physics. It kind of stimulates this. So there's some also interesting collaborative component to it, and the fibers look similar enough. That said, Levy flights may be another way to approach it, because what you see in culture, and this is in culture, they do sometimes kind of wobble in one place, and then they lunge. They lunge, but they lunge because they reach out, or they feel with their, you know, filopodia of the growth cone, they suddenly latch onto a substrate, or they latch onto some kind of beat another axon, or that's in culture again. So you can see it, but it's a slightly unnatural kind of rarefied situation. They do this when they catch onto something, and then they pull themselves up, sort of like in a pull-up kind of way, which is very fast, and which does look like a Levy flight. Now the question is, and that's something that's actually bothering or interesting, or we find it sort of just bothering, I guess, at some on some days, but also making it interesting, is to what extent the growth of that fiber actually is dependent on these attachment sites, because in the brain it's going to be very, very dense, so dense, and there's so many things to attach to, that you can happily travel in almost any arbitrary trajectory, always being attached to something. Like, truly, it's so compact with other dendrites, other axons, also glial cells.
That would be true if you have infinite resources.
Right.
Like, if the organism, I mean, I'm just talking in general, this where these Levy flights come from. If you have infinite resources, then like, you can sample all the possibilities.
Yeah.
But if you have limited resources, then there's a evolutionary pressure to make a decision, right? To actually innervate the volume that you need to innervate, and then an energetically efficient strategy is to launch, right? To just like move forward, and then I don't want to anthropomorphize neurons, but it's like if you a switch or a winner-takes-all mechanism triggers, and then it makes a decision, grows, and then again it allows time to...
Can I ask what that kind of thing would mean at the molecular level? Because we think of these things as responding to molecular responses, not really to be conscious decision-makers.
No.
And so... The kind of growth rule you're talking about has to be implemented at the molecular level. So if there's I have a receptor on something that's in the environment, and I can attach to that, and there are lots of things that I could attach to.
But you can have in the growth cone, right, multiple receptors, there are multiple signals, and you can assume a process in which you're accumulating energy, right? And then you're going to use it. You can use it to continue as a relatively slow random walk, like totally Brownian, or because you need to the axon will then, even by noise, like stochastic resonance, just chooses one of those signals and says that the gradient is in this direction. I'm going to use all my energy, but in that direction, and then I'll stop. Actually, E. coli, you brought up E. coli, moves a little bit like that. It samples the concentration of water, and then it dashes
in the opposite
gradient of water.
Like the tumbling and whatever.
Yes, exactly. It goes from tumbling to like directed swimming.
But so for that, I think they have some kind of molecular mechanism
to
answer your question, that we actually see this kind of lunging in cell culture. And the way it actually goes is, and the growth cone will produce very long filopodia, right? So incredibly thin, long fibers. One filopodium feels something and firmly attaches to that, whatever surface is, and then it contracts. So very rapidly, there's some kind of disassembly of actin, microtubule, and so the entire axon gets rapidly pulled. Now that is possible because the membrane itself is like so bubble, it's liquid, and so lipid, and so you can stretch it. It's stretchable. The issue is how do you sustain, how do you maintain it when it's being stretched? And as I said, now there are studies with magnetic beads where people do it. Axons actually can respond to this very healthily. Being stretched is not a huge deal for them, it seems, as long as you don't stretch, you know, obviously too much. They are capable of just triggering, you know, just turning on the transcriptional machinery and filling in all the whatever proteins they need to insert in that stretched membrane. So that is biologically definitely feasible, but so it is very, very good.
Can I extend that just a little bit? Because if a filopodium is doing that and sending out their growth cones, mm-hmm. sending out filopodia in various directions, then it's going to go in one of those directions. Mm-hmm. So if the filopodia are going in every possible direction, mm-hmm. then it's possible for the axon to make a turn in any possible direction. If they go in a few directions, then I could, at the next moment, I could go in any mm-hmm. one of those directions. And so that is a potential mechanism for restricting the degrees of freedom for the next movement in a direction way, and creating the kinds of correlations that you're thinking about that tell you something about that nature.
But I would like to like switch it a little bit to like what the end result, mm-hmm. right? So you could have a volume, and I'm not sure about the specific of this. You can have one of these fibers, and it does this kind of like moving and having this super diffusive, I describe the axon as a super diffusive process. But if you have so many, right, is it possible? I mean, just to go into the computational aspect of this, and I like this because it's like, oh, okay, you're sampling and moving, and then this axon is basically influencing lung areas. And that's how you're maximizing the effect of that neuron. That's a very attractive point. But if you have so many, then at the end, maybe you end up with a homogeneous distribution of the axons, right? If you look at every cubic, 10 cubic microns or one micron, the density of the, I don't know the answer, but is it the same?
This is a good point. Why? Because this is where we started. Mm-hmm. The serotonin axon matrix is not everywhere the same. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of pattern to it. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is pointing in the direction of what could create that pattern. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could talk about what you think creates the pattern. Does this diffusive model predict the pattern that you actually see?
Right. So we, the model, again, the model that we are actively using now is the fractional Brownian motion model. It's an interesting process with an interesting history, but also it's based on a recent discovery, supercomputing-based discovery in physics, which shows that super-diffusive fractional Brownian motion, but not any super-diffusive process. Mm-hmm. That is important, that FBM, fractional Brownian motion, in this super-diffusive mode will accumulate at borders. So these particles that have been studied by physicists will produce higher densities at the borders or obstacles. And so when now you have a brain which has a complex three-dimensional geometry, and obviously it is a limited bounded space to begin with, the curvature, the structure, maybe even not, you know, things like ventricles or, you know, corpus callosum or anterior commissure will produce obstacles for these fibers. And that geometry, as it interacts with internal obstacles, may shape specific region-dependent densities. It's a hypothesis at this point, but it's also very appealing and interesting to physicists because fractional Brownian motion is one of the kind of forefronts of multiparticle physics also. They use it for other purposes, not axons, for particle distributions and so on. But it has not simply, our group was one of the kind of first to push it to three-dimensional bounded spaces where it's a complex three-dimensional object, but also it has obstacles in it. And the difficulty is that you cannot, even though they do accumulate at the borders. This process has an inherent memory, right? So each increment knows or is correlated statistically with the previous increment.
Increment of growth.
Exactly. So when you have reflection at the boundaries, that single reflection will be remembered statistically by that fiber. And now how much biologically realistic is, I mean, that's another question, I guess. But the memory makes it very complex to predict in more subtle detail. So the accumulation at the boundaries is a given, but the more complex subtle distribution is difficult to predict because it will ultimately be shaped by all the reflections, all the you know, obstacles this fiber has encountered. And of course, this memory is sort of fades away, but it's a long range memory. It's a process that is almost notorious for having a long range memory. And so when you move in three dimensions, it just becomes a sort of fascinating problem. It's like, what will I see if I let them?
I think the fascination, and I haven't read that part of your work, but back in the day, people will say, some people will argue that you could not see super anomalous diffusion in 3D because the probabilities were too low, especially subdiffusion. But I'm not sure about super diffusion, but it was like, oh, okay, these might not exist in 3D, but the fact that they're there is kind of fascinating.
Subdiffusion is super diffusion. You get pushed because you advance sort of being positively correlated.
Right.
So you get pushed to the border much easily.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the papers that we've published, or my colleagues have published with me on, and more on the physics side, they actually try to, you're absolutely right, they try to use shorter intervals for subdiffusion because in subdiffusion you go back and forth, you're anti-correlated, and so it's kind of difficult to get to the edge because you tend to wobble in one place, actually more so than in just normal Brownian diffusion.
Mm. And because I work in subdiffusion, I would say that anti-correlation is correlation.
Yeah, anti-correlation is correlation, right? It just, generally negative correlation between, of course, it's correlation. But yeah, so subdiffusion is more difficult. Subdiffusion is used to study crowded environments.
Yeah.
It's super important in biology, just something that we don't use it.
So I want you to tell, I mean, I would like to ask you to, if this idea that it is an obstacle-based shaping of the matrix, what will happen during aging and issues like ischemia, like microischemias, or tau accumulation? Will that affect, and then you will have affect the matrix, and then that could correlate with the mood disorders?
It could. I mean, one thing that dates all the way back to my PhD years, and in a way, maybe at some subconscious level, that's where it goes back to. We used to do, back in the day, a lot of tracing, traditional old-fashioned tracing where we'd inject a tracer in one place and then look, where that tracer traveled. These days, of course, we have all kind of cool transgenic, intersectional genetic methods and all of this, which are much more advanced. But back then, we were already past horseradish peroxidase, so I used the cholera toxin B, which is actually non-toxic. It's just a subunit of cholera. But it's a very good anti-retrograde transporter. So we'd use quite a bit of this. But this is, I digress a little bit, because what I wanted to say is that when I look at the needle tracts after the injection, and of course you need to confirm that you injected in the right place, so you do histological sectioning and staining, I'd often see serotonin axons accumulating around the needle tract. And back then it was just, well, this is kind of odd, but I'm doing other things, so I'm not going to focus on this. It's kind of weird phenomenon here, but now it makes more sense to me. They get stuck because there's a cut in the tissue.
So the way you guys are talking, it makes it sound like the serotonin axons are continuing to fuse throughout life. It's not a developmental process. It's
That's actually what I believe is happening to some extent. And again, not all people will agree with this. but they regenerate very easily. Yeah. And when something regenerates easily, that's got to be, it's not like all of us get whacked on the head and need to regenerate. There is something inherent in and important in their ability to regrow easily. Hmm. And so I suspect, and I wish we could do this experiment and see them kind of moving in our brains and growing, maybe not as fast, we wouldn't be able to see it, you know, just in a normal time frame. But I think they do actually grow, even in adulthood. And they also get interrupted and probably you know, some segments of them degenerate and some segments actually, you know, just regrow. And so it's a much more dynamic picture than the classic, you know, neuroanatomical view where they just project, build those densities, and that's it. To me, it's more of a graduate program where you have a normal, like a standard number of people all the time, or student classes, but it's different students each time, or, new graduate students. So it's sort of the fibers, again, the density may look stable, but the individual players may actually, in branches, may be newly produced, some of them may be older. And I'm actually very interested in this now that we've implemented Brainbow and we can individually label them, because we see fibers that are highly varicose, meaning they have dilated segments with incredibly thin inter-varicose segments. They're so thin that, in fact, what you're actually looking at is a necklace of beads on a very thin string. But they look, under the microscope, as you just see the beads themselves. And that you see it in the adult brain. However, this kind of beady appearance has been associated with developing fibers. So they're massively beady in the development as they develop, and that's been shown. So why is it that these individual fibers now suddenly, you know, you see smooth fibers, not beady, then there is one beady one. And it could be that they are just morphologically different, but it could also be that this is a fiber that's maybe not young, but it's a fiber that's
so
actually
maybe if
developing.
These fiber pathways are constantly rebuilding themselves. That's what sets them apart from the others. The axons that travel in the other way and grow in the other way are following pathways that are laid out for them in the tissue, and they don't have the freedom to just grow anywhere they want to and whenever they want.
They have to go through all the complexity of the
And they can regenerate for a... That in itself, I think, shows us something, because that means they don't need guiding factors, because these factors will not be present in the adult brain anymore. Development is a complicated business, right? So these factors, transcriptional factors, are very, highly timed. They need to happen at very specific points in time, in a very specific sequence.
I guess it brings it, also opens up the idea for researching TBS, right? Like traumatic brain injury.
That'll
be an interesting thing. I mean, that would be a self-contained experiment that you can do once
and
one hemisphere and the other.
That's a great way for us to finish today. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. This has been a fun and wild discussion. And thank you, Skirmantis.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Fidel.
Thank you, Charlie.
And this is our last podcast for the semester. We're going to be taking a break, so come back in the fall for more Neuroscientists Talk Shop.